Hello and Happy New Year to all of you. This is January 3rd, 2021. And this is Kevin Ann at Eagle Strong Voice speaking to you from the Republic of Kanata, formerly the Dominion of Canada, now under common law republic jurisdiction. This is a New Year's message to all of you. It's entitled Birthing the Better Land. And this message is coming to all of you from myself and the Sovereign Republic of Kanata. Now, I want to start with a couple of really heartwarming and relevant quotes. The first from a man called Joseph Plum Martin, who is a survivor of the American Revolution. He served in the Continental Army from joining as a young boy right through to manhood. And many years after the revolution, he wrote, "Those who joined our ranks and ran away when the shooting began knew nothing of our long suffering and what our nation cost us in blood. But neither did they know the glory of our triumph, nor did they earn a place in the life of our republic." And Thomas Paine, in his book Common Sense, wrote in the same period, "We have it in our power to begin the world over again." We have it in our power to begin the world over again. That simple truth is at the basis of all that we do. We do not take our cue from the old dying regime, but from the new nation we're bringing into being. Because what was a newborn just a year ago has stood up and walked among us during the year 2020. A newborn that is the sovereign republic struggling to grow amidst the corruption of a dying regime called Canada. Well, we have the COVID police state to thank for that growth in the way that it's awakened many people to the global corporatocracy imposing its hideous dictatorship on all of us. But also many people on the ground who have begun to do more than talk, who have begun to establish the republic through action. Our republic is in its infant stage, and it's at its most vulnerable right now, for the same reason that another child provoked the wrath of a king named Herod, because no tyrant can tolerate the unshackling of his slaves, and that tyrant will kill the infant liberty in its cradle. Nevertheless, we here in Kanata have shaken the throne of the tyrant. To give you an example, last February, our republic was active in just 13 communities. Now it's active in 109 communities, nearly a tenfold growth in our local groups. Now, our message that people can govern themselves, not only can govern themselves, but must at this time, and reclaim the nation directly, that's caught the imagination of many Canadians who were formerly complacent. And that tenfold growth in the number of our local groups has been accompanied by a 20-fold increase in the number of people who have taken out citizenship in the republic by taking the citizenship oath, whereby they renounce all allegiance to the Crown of England, so-called Queen Elizabeth, and the Government of Canada, and taking instead a pledge of allegiance, pledge of citizenship to the Republic of Kanata, and stands within its national jurisdiction. I mean, even government polls indicate that over 60% of Canadians now want a republic, and they want to cut ties with the now criminally convicted Crown of England. It's kind of like what John Adams observed in 1793 when he said the revolution triumphed in the hearts and minds of the people before any shots were fired. And that same process is happening now in Kanata. The revolution is triumphing in the minds of people. And the question is, how do we put it into practice? Well, the good news is that people are flocking to our republic in a way that we can't even keep up to, the number of volunteers every week. And yet the downside is that the impulse to liberty in people is continually constrained by their fear and their learned dependency. We experience this in all the assemblies, all the local cell groups we're setting up. Even the most awakened citizen in our republic tend to balk when it comes to passing and then enforcing their own laws. When they pass laws that abolish the COVID measures, issue arrest warrants, or reclaim tax money and keep it in the local community, they pass the laws fine, and yet they hesitate to enforce. Because the idea of governing ourselves is fine in theory, but frightening in practice, because at that point, when we practice it, we are directly challenging the corporate state for power. Even a very aware Republican citizen will still ask the question, well, who gives us the authority to do this? Not even recognizing that the authority is within here, the sovereign people. It begins and ends with us. You see, our lifelong conditioning to defer to other people and to seek our own safety first, that's the biggest roadblock to the rise of our republic. And in fact, it's far more of a roadblock than any overt repression by the police or the state, because we ourselves are holding ourselves back. We, the policeman in our own mind, is our enemy. Well, that caution denies us the chance to earn our freedom and be changed in the process of struggling for it. That's how change happens. It doesn't happen by reading stuff off the internet or talking in a group. Change happens when you engage with your enemy and you learn from experience their nature. The nature of what you're up against can only be learned by contact with it. As Samuel Adams wrote back in the American Revolution, our people won their final independence from the British Empire only when they clashed with it in arms. The peacetime patriot chooses the path of forbearance and least resistance, clasping to the chains forged around his thoughts until those chains are blasted away. Until those chains are blasted away. It's the nature of the universe for change and conflict to occur. We can't avoid that conflict. We have to talk among ourselves and then act, knowing how best to have that conflict serve us rather than the corporatocracy. Well, I've witnessed this truth time and again over the past year in the over 24 local republic assemblies I have helped to organize and I've sparked all across Canada. Often people will pass their own bylaws, but then they refuse to enforce them. Rather than elect and train their own common law sheriffs, they'll seek out allies among the local police. Well, this avoidance has weakened our resolve in our ranks, and it's actually aided the destruction of our local assemblies by saboteurs and infiltrators when they do come in, as they have all over the West Coast in particular. And yet something deeper than fear is at work in this mental servitude of people. And that deeper thing is really a spiritual captivity to the status quo and its group mind. And that captivity has to be broken for our actions to catch up to our words and our beliefs. Well, to give you an example from history, it was no accident that the American Revolution was preceded by a few decades by something called the Great Awakening. It was a grassroots spiritual revival movement all over Eastern America. It swept the local farming and local town communities, and it really set the stage for the revolution. Many American settlers expected Christ's imminent return, and they sought to prepare themselves inwardly and outwardly in the world for the new world that was to come, a world of freedom, love, and liberty. Well, in so doing, in reclaiming their own sovereignty in that, their own hearts and minds, they learned to be spiritually sovereign and cut their dependence on the established churches and on their crown-ruled bishops. When many so-called ordinary people learned to seek the truth for themselves and seek their own salvation among themselves, the will to achieve political independence followed naturally. Those people were ready. As a matter of fact, by learning to govern their own minds and hearts through that inner freedom, through that Great Awakening movement, the formerly colonized Americans made the revolution possible on the ground. And that's the important point for us. In fact, many of the frontline soldiers in the American Continental Army were citizen preachers in the Great Awakening's free congregations run by and for the people. Not churches, congregational assemblies run by and for the people, knowing that the kingdom of heaven is within each of us, not within a church or churchly rulers. Well, it may be self-evident that here in Canada, we are greatly and badly in need for such a spiritual awakening. But such a fundamental change cannot be summoned on command, especially in a spiritual dead zone like the global corporate culture that so seems to shackle many people's minds and lives. It's undeniable that Canadians in particular seem incapable of imagining anything other than their servitude to a system that drips with the blood of the innocent. In the past and still today. Well, I learned this personally and up close over many years after stumbling on the hard evidence of Canada's mass murder of tens of thousands of innocent children in the so-called Indian residential school and how that genocide is continuing today. When I and a few others placed the truth of that slaughter before Christian Canada, it responded with not only a general yawn of indifference, but with an inhumanity that proved the guilt of entire society, and particularly its churches. For the same church and state that tore children to pieces and murdered them, then absolve themselves of that crime without a trace of heartfelt sorrow, reducing an unspeakable abomination to a stale issue of monetary compensation and apology, as if you can apologize to the dead. Well, people who act that way, who have no feeling for the ones they've slaughtered, that's the way the Walking Dead act, people without a soul. Well, having had my own life destroyed by these same ghoulish killers, my former allegiance to the corpse called Canada vaporized many, many years ago. But many of us with a foothold in the system who still rely on it for things, and including psychologically, those kinds of people reside in a gray zone between the new world and the old world. And they're still bonded to the very thing they verbally or mentally oppose. Now, that's the irony. People will speak against the system, and yet they can't imagine breaking from it. That bond is so deep that they're blind to it. Even when that reliance on the system carries on when the system's attacking them and stopping them from asserting their freedom, they still cannot imagine anything but that system. Well, our blindness to the horror that should make us all vomit, that should repulse us, comes from a kind of spiritual possession. It isn't just mental dependence. It's that we are spiritually in a state of possession. We're raised in that state of possession by an unseen, call it an oversoul, whose power over us cannot be destroyed simply by individual effort, but rather by creating a new alternative spirit, a collective presence that manifests physically as a republic, but as a spiritual reality. We imagine ourselves to be free enough to create that different presence on our own, in the form of our own sovereign republic. But when we actually try to do so, our possession will often restrain our minds and our actions. To give you an example, since March of 2020, 11 of our assemblies have been deliberately destroyed from within by paid operatives employing standard divide-and-conquer methods. But none of their subversion could have worked unless people in these assemblies were already disposed to fear and manipulation and lies. Well, fortunately, from the ruins of those groups that were destroyed has emerged a remnant of citizens who've learned from the experience. They've learned from the contact with the thing we're fighting, and they've been liberated by their possession by it, from having engaged with it and fought it. That's how you break the shackles around your mind and soul. And from that experience now, they're carrying on as veteran leaders who are establishing local republic cell groups that are less prone to infiltration, having learned a lesson. And that hardened remnant is slowly growing across Canada. What matters is that each of us learn from our experience and never give up, but always persist with the vision and program of the Republic. And my own life is an example of the power of not giving up. Over 20 years, I and a few other people forced the truth of genocide onto the agenda. We even forced a pope and three cardinals to resign because of pure determination and not giving up. Well, if our own great spiritual awakening will occur in Canada, it will emerge from out of these hard-won lessons and the many battles to come. In the course of these tests, something will be sparked that none of us can foresee prior to any battle. And this is important. A power that emerges in the course of fighting that you can't foresee beforehand. And that power is referred to in The Art of War. When General Sun Tzu identifies it in this way, he says, "Do not avoid hopeless situations. Embrace them. Place your troops where they cannot retreat, but they must fight to the death. In such an inescapable position, they will discover a resolve and a courage they never knew they had, and which is more powerful than the sum of their parts. Necessity and conflict evoke such power. It cannot be planned or foreseen." Well, that's amazing when you think of it. That unexpected power is in truth the doorway to the new society we envision. We can't imagine the courage and determination we have until it's required. But once we enter into that, a new door opens up. And it gives people the chance to see the force that can make the Republic a working possibility. If there's one general error our organizers and citizens continue to make, it's to not trust the power of a hopeless situation, and not trust the capacity of people to change suddenly and unexpectedly. We have to use every moment to not simply teach people about the Republic and train them into how to create it, but we have to prepare for to take advantage of those brief and passing opportunities to strike at our enemies when they're off balance. Many such moments of opportunity appear, and they have to be grasped firmly once we have the eyes and the wisdom to recognize the moments. Napoleon advised this, saying, "There is a key place and moment in every battle, which if not seized, will turn against you and cause your defeat. We have to be aware of what that key moment is." Well, as 2021 dawns, our republic exists in many scattered seeds that have rooted and they're beginning to sprout. But the only thing holding back their growth is really our own fear and caution. Now is the time for us to be audacious and to raise high our flag and for our nation, for all to see, by constantly launching public actions that directly reclaim Canada under our new jurisdiction, seizing the buildings and the assets of the Crown corporations, the genocidal churches. All exists now in our hands. All the property and lands and forfeited of the Crown, it's gone. It's forfeited and now belongs to the people. Our local cells and assemblies have to unite into a national presence so that everyone can recognize the Republic as a working alternative to this criminal conspiracy called Canada. And towards that end, our upcoming constitutional convention will create the framework and the institutions of our new nation, including a national Supreme Court of the Republic and a national Congress. Well, we found from our experience and from history that the power of any system is in constant change and flux, and it can shift in any moment. And that if the revolutionary movement is seasoned and positioned properly to seize that moment, even the strongest tyranny can topple. But without an alternative power to take its place, people will neither assist that downfall nor help build a new society. And so our final message today is this. It is our job now to create that alternative known as the Sovereign Republic of Canada in our communities where we are and unite those grassroots movement into our national presence. We know in our hearts that it is within our power to begin the world over again. Let us do so in this exciting year of 2021. republicofcanada.ca, murderbydecree.com. This is Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice, co-convener of the Republic of Canada. Stay strong, carry it on. Thank you.
Word up, Word of Mouth Wednesday. We're here with a guest here that we've been talking about on the radio, or we've been talking with on the radio as well, Kevin Annett, who's in Toronto right now. And we've chosen a historic location here because Kevin Annett's work's been, you know, hidden from history. This is a place, William Mackenzie House, we're right near, that's been, I guess, remembered in history. What are your thoughts, or what do you know anything about William Lyon Mackenzie?
Well, he's a spiritual brother to me and anybody who believes in sovereignty, because he challenged the family compact. That was the church and colonial elite that ran Upper Canada. And actually, they still run Canada. The financial oligarchies, the crown, the churches. And because this revolution was defeated at the time, the church had absolute authority, including to run the residential schools and cause this genocide. So we're standing here. I'm standing here as a spiritual son of William Lyon Mackenzie, saying it's time to carry on that revolution he started. And we're doing that by sharing the two-row wampum flag, which was the original flag treaty signed between our people and the indigenous nations of this land, saying we will live in equality. And we realize we can't live in equality under the Crown of England. We can't live in equality under this corporate system, which says that the land is owned only by a few. And so we are reclaiming this moment and this space to say we have to make all of Canada sovereign land for all the people who live here. And that's really why I'm here, and this is why we're putting the Crown and the churches on trial for their genocide of Indigenous people. That was genocide aimed at my people as well, and that's why we have to stand together.
For real.
Yeah, and we're here, we're with Kevin Annett, but we're also with Tohoke Tote, who's going to tell us about, some knowledge that he knows about. Well, have you ever heard of William Lyon Mackenzie?
Well, I can't say that I am an expert. Kevin seems to have taught me a little bit. William Lyon Mackenzie King, I've studied. This is the best prime minister that we've had. Guy who wrote the Bank of Canada Act in 1934. And he is quoted in many great democracies as saying, usury, once in control, will destroy any nation. And we're getting destroyed now from it. Thanks. Well, never. We won't get into it. But William Lyon Mackenzie King, this guy's grandson. Grandson?
Yeah, grandson.
His grandson.
Yep.
go figure, 24 years as the prime minister and kept the bankers from us.
Yeah.
Till Trudeau. Justin, you're next.
For real, yeah, and we're at Mackenzie House, which is on Bond Street, which is actually really close to CKLN Radio, and that's where, you know, I've interviewed both of you guys on the radio, and I was wondering, you know, with what's been happening, what are your thoughts on the situation, like, in Toronto with community radio and the possibilities, you know, that it could be shut down by the license revoked?
Well, you know, I was at Co-op Radio for 9 years, and they've done the same thing there. The corporate interests now can buy up community radio, and it's the same oligarchy that Mackenzie was fighting. It's this economic oligarchy that thinks that they have the right to control the airwaves. And so we've got to keep public airwaves, we've got to keep CKLN strong and community owned, not owned by corporate interests of the government. And that's one of our mouthpieces, so we have to fight hard to keep that in the hands of the people.
I agree.
For real, yeah. There's been a recent notice that's been sent out to all the members of CKLN with a... something about an R, the document was called R&R, and I was hoping it would be, rest and relax, but this is rules and regulations. New rules and regulations are coming, and do you, Kevin, I know just because you've been involved with community radio, do you have any, thoughts on, you know, what they're actually going to be doing with community radio?
Well, if it's anything like what happened at Vancouver Co-op Radio, they've run in the same thing. 3 years ago, there was a secret deal between the staff at Co-op Radio and Jim Pattison media mogul interests to basically help buy up the station. They never told anybody. They violated their own rules and ethics by not telling anybody about this secret corporate acquisition and funding. And so it sounds like, if it's at all like what happened in Vancouver, they bring in rules whereby, for example, the staff can't be criticized anymore. Anything that's said on the air can cause immediate removal of a program or the cancellation of a program. I mean, this is total dictatorship. So if it's the same thing that Freya Zoltz was doing in Vancouver, this is a national phenomenon, and it's being organized by the feds in conjunction with corporate media interests.
The corporatocracy.
Yep, corporatocracy.
That's a better word for it.
Right. And what Mackenzie was trying to do, I guess, was to break away from the crown. And he was trying to, you know, the family compact was connected with everything that was going on in Europe and, you know, controlled by, people with definite connections there. What are your thoughts on, having Canada as a republic? Because I know, like, Kevin, you had the Republic of Canada was a... idea or hope for the future. What are your thoughts on the Republic?
We need it. We got to stop this allegiance to false foreign jurisdictional powers that came and imposed themselves without any legitimacy here on the land and on the people here. We need to declare a republic that's federated so that all the different indigenous nations can be...
And independent from England.
Independent from England.
Finally.
And corporate interests.
Finally.
We can federate everybody into a whole union of equal nations, and I think that's what we need to do. One way we do it is yesterday we were right down the street here at all the churches demanding that they be brought to trial for their murder of kids in residential schools, and that's what we're trying to do in London in September, and we hope that here in Toronto there'll be similar actions and forums at the same time so that the survivors of these schools and others who are being harmed today can come forward and name the names, and we put these people on trial, and we establish common law courts where we can do that. We don't trust the courts of the Crown.
Admiralty courts, all of them.
Forget them all.
We got to
do
corporations.
We got to do what my ancestors did in Ireland, and is set up our own courts under the nose of the British and say we don't recognize them anymore. We're our own nation now. That's what we need to do here in Canada.
Yeah, all you need to do is follow the two-road wampum to us. That's it.
Two-road wampum.
The two-road wampum. Gushwenta.
For real, yeah. We're speaking with Tohoke Tote and Kevin Annett. And Kevin Annett, I know you're also known as Eagle Strong Voice. I was wondering how did you get that name?
That was given to me by Chief Louis Daniels in Winnipeg when he adopted me into the Turtle Clan in the Anishinaabe Nation, gave me that name. He said I was to carry that name to my people because I couldn't do the work in his community, he couldn't do the work in mine, but together, walking like the two-row wampum, working in each of our worlds to bring about that sovereignty and justice. So that was an authorization that he gave me to do that work.
Okay, and what... is going on with your tour in Canada? Because I know, for instance, your most recent press release has to do with your upcoming appearance in Hamilton. What's the story with that?
Well, what just happened was the Hamilton police notified the organizers of the Mohawk College that they were going to send an undercover police operative in to monitor what I said. And, you know, let's be clear, and that happens all the time, but the fact that they were notifying them was clear intimidation. And so I wrote to this policeman and said, we're telling the world about this, and we want to put you on notice that we consider this an attempt to obstruct our investigation at the behest of your employers, the Crown of England and the Government of Canada. So if people want to follow more of that, it's hiddenfromhistory.org.
Very good.
And what's your site?
Dalgate.ws. They stole everything they got. Everything. Yeah. Throughout history.
So he came here after he was exiled?
Yeah.
Okay.
He moved back here.
First mayor. I didn't know he was the first mayor.
First mayor, and
he was exiled after that, right? Because the actual, he was first mayor.
But he fled to the United States?
Yeah, he fled to the United States, and he was arrested in the United States, too. He spent time in jail.
So
it wasn't just all smooth sailing.
But what he, actually, the first place he fled was called Navy Island, which was an island in between the U.S. and Canada, which is right near Niagara Falls, right near the falls.
Yeah, okay.
And he was trying to establish that as his own independent territory, his own independent country. And then I guess somehow he ended up in the on the American side and then in a jail and... He had a pretty crazy life from the history. Judging from the history books, that's one guy that the history books have been written about, William Lyon Mackenzie. And City of Toronto controls that property. And next time we'll try to get permission, next time we film there. Word up. All right, word up. Hidden from History continues. We're right here at Ryerson campus now. We've got another person that's remembered in history, Egerton Ryerson. He's got a statue here. We've got a whole university named after him. And we've got Kevin Anna of Hidden from History here. Kevin Anna, have you heard about Egerton Ryerson?
Yeah, the guy's a real bastard, actually. First of all, he was commissioned by the Crown to come over here to keep an eye on the rebellion in Lower Canada and Upper Canada. But as part of that, he initially was an ally of William Lyon Mackenzie, but then he cut off ties with him and broke ranks and started to denounce him because he was critical of the church. And Ryerson was a big Methodist church preacher and official. And he eventually established the plan. He had a plan to educate the Indians. And he established the original plan for the Indian residential schools in Ontario. So this is a guy who had the master plan for how to assimilate, which is a polite way of saying wipe out, Indigenous culture. And to name a university after, I think, is quite ridiculous. And I think we should rename the university according to someone from the Indigenous nations, one of our heroes, and not one of the establishments.
For real, yeah. And thanks a lot, Kevin, for getting the information out that you've been getting out. What is your thoughts on universities, and how has your work been taken at the universities around Canada?
Well, universities are big corporations, they're like churches, but within it there's a lot of, actually I get the best response from high school and college students, a lot of groundswell of discontent and rebellion these days in universities all over the world that I go, but especially Canada, and I'm really hopeful every time I come to a place like this that people are going to, students can use the time they have to do the research and the organizing and the other stuff that's needed for our movement, so thank you all.
For real.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Kevin Annett, check out the work, hiddenfromhistory.org, hiddennolonger.com. Word up, word out. Well, check out the event too. Kevin Annett speaking at Ryerson University.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Kevin Annett, co-convener of the Republic of Canada, and we are doing an educational today on issues of common law, the Republic, and building our resistance. And one of the things that we always say to people in these sessions is our best educator is the experience we have every day and our ability to learn in a group, not just as individuals, but pooling our experiences when something happens to us, bringing back to the group and finding how we do respond eventually as a community to this. Someone just mentioned a few minutes ago about the whole issue of mandatory vaccinations and how we resist that. What do we do if stores require proof of vaccination? Again, in everything we do, think in terms of what is listed in the back of our common law training manual and the whistleblower manual, where we have 50 excerpts from The Art of War by Sun Tzu. And it's a very important set of quotes to read because the whole focus in The Art of War is how does a small group beat a larger group? How does a small army take on a whole power?
and use the power of your opponent against it. And, you know, it's really a manual for guerrilla warfare. And the reality is that's the situation we're in. The power of our adversary is mostly psychological. They have, for example, no manpower in the world to enforce mandatory vaccinations on millions of people. If even a minority of those millions of people say no. So their power rests on our compliance, which is based on ignorance and fear. And we are here to overcome both ignorance and fear, but you do that as a group, you do it together, not simply as one man army going out there, because you won't last long if you try that. And so the whole purpose of this is to arm us here and also use this as an organizing tool to build our local republic cell groups and then ultimately assemblies. Again, I urge people to go to republicofcanada.ca and our three books, especially The Case for Canada, which outlines the vision and the program of the Republic. Now that's that book, the content and the Constitution for the Republic is under revision. We welcome your amendments to amend the Constitution and vote on it in the upcoming spring convention that we're going to be holding. You have to be a citizen. And so we urge people, especially who are organizing local groups, to take out citizenship, and then you're inside the circle and you can start influencing the policy and direction of the Republic. And that book, first book, The Case for Canada. Secondly, the Common Law Training Manual, which lays out, it's called Establishing the Reign of Natural Liberty, a Common Law Training Manual. And that lays out the theory, the philosophy behind common law, where it comes from, and how you use it to set up common law courts and all of our work. And finally, a book that's really relevant for today, which is the Whistleblower Manual. It's called Truth Teller's Shield. And it really summarizes the experiences of a lot of people who come up against state-organized smear and disinformation campaigns, and how the state uses divide and conquer methods on us. And again, relying on people's fear and ignorance. And so it's been of a special relevance to our work, because on the West Coast in particular, we've had nearly a dozen assemblies now taken down using the same methods every time. And once we get large enough and we affect vested interests, then yeah, we will be subject to these attacks. But they're based on methods that we know about. The advantage of taking on a big adversary is they can only act in predictable ways. They have a hierarchy, they have a chain of command. Everybody has to answer to somebody above them. And so they can only react to us in certain ways. We know what those ways are, and they're listed in that book. And so our advantage is we can do the unpredictable. As a guerrilla movement, your strategy lies in mobility, secrecy, and unpredictability. You never do what your enemy expects them to do. That's kind of bottom line in all the work we're doing. Don't do the expected. Like they say in the Air Force, never fly in a straight line for 30 seconds or you're dead in a combat situation. Same thing. You don't do the predictable. You don't say, okay, we're going to have a protest. They expect protests. They expect petitions and all of that. What they don't expect is things like, one example, some folks a couple of years ago walked right into the headquarters. And this was in connection to our campaign about genocide. they walked right into the headquarters of the United Church and had eyewitnesses to their crimes come in and just stand there in their office outlining it and filming it. And what you did there, just like the occupations of churches, you went outside their experience. You went outside what they expected. And that's kind of a model for everything we do. So always keep that in mind. What I'm going to lay out briefly, and then we'll open this for discussion, is really what we're trying to do. And the way we're raised in this culture is to always think in terms of an individual solution, something that's going to protect us. We think in very self-preserving terms. How am I going to be safe in this situation? How can I avoid this? Okay, that's a very defensive way of thinking. And by doing that, you're leaving the power in the hands of the system. An example of that is I was always raised, and it goes back 45 years, I've been doing political actions and that. protests. If you don't like something, you get some people together, stand outside a government building, you know, demand change, right? But don't forget that very act, what does it do? The implicit message there is it's saying, you have the authority, we're asking for something from you, please give it to us. You can be as militant as you like, you can shout as much as you like, you're still asking them to give you something. Now, our whole strategy is turning that around. We don't ask for anything. First of all, we know the system is essentially criminal and corrupt. And if they give you anything, it'll be on their terms. It's going to be a way to help them and minimize your power and influence. We know that from long experience. You see that in their courts. You see that in everyday life. It's almost like a system of energy parasitism. They're feeding off our energy. They feed off our taxes, our labor, our compliance, our votes. Okay. It's like you visualize it like energy sucking from us. But what we do is we reverse it. Sun Tzu calls it qi. He has this really interesting quote in The Art of War. He says, whoever controls the qi of a battle will win it, no matter how small they are. Now, what qi is the essential spirit or energy of a situation, right? And the way you can control that when you're just a few people is you set the terms of battle at the beginning. You don't let them define what the issue is. You define it. So, for example, when we started this work many years ago about the residential school genocide, the media was saying some poor children suffered abuse. And that was a word they deliberately chose because the language is very important. We'll get into language in a minute. Language is designed to control thoughts. So even the word to spell a word, spell, you're casting a spell by the language, right? And what it does is by using that word abuse, you're defining it as a relatively mild thing. Now, children were tortured, killed, sterilized, trafficked, murdered en masse. Half of them never came back, but they call that abuse. Like, you know, you've abused our relationship, or to abuse somebody, you use harsh language. It's a deliberately vague term designed to control the thoughts of people, control the narrative. That, you know, a lot of bad things didn't happen. There was some unfortunate things, but now we're going to correct it with some money and apology, right? That's their whole narrative. Well, our narrative was exactly the opposite. We said, no, this is genocide. This was an attempt to wipe out people under the guise of religion. They killed off most of the indigenous people. They're still killing them off. This is about genocide past and present. And we said that year after year when we did all our actions. Net effect is, last year, Trudeau admitted to genocide. He even used the word. So by us repeating that word long enough, the system had to come around and start using it themselves. Now, to bring it up to today, the system is defining the issue as a pandemic. Now, anyone with a brain knows that isn't true. There isn't a pandemic. Look at the statistics. I said to a cop the other day, you know, I've been walking around without one of those muzzles on my face for 9 months. I've got bronchial asthma and I'm 64. Don't you think I'd be sick by now if there was an actual bug out there? So from my experience, it doesn't exist. It only exists in the cyber world by which they influence people's minds. And so we define the issue as, no, this is a corporate global police state. And they're using a health emergency to impose a new kind of society on all of us. And what we are doing is reestablishing the rule of law and democracy and sovereignty for all the people on the ground. We are doing that. That is what we're establishing. We don't vary from that, because the minute you step outside that and operate on their terms, they've taken your power. And that's the problem with a lot of the groups now that campaign on common law. And I believe a number of them are actually controlled opposition front groups to channel people away from our whole message of a sovereign republic and people taking back their power. Because what the common law groups often talk about is you just need to learn certain things about common law, then you can navigate the system and be safe. Okay, it's that defensive way of thinking again. But we say the opposite. No, you have to use that knowledge to create something new, because you don't defeat a system by attacking it. By attacking, you're feeding it with your energy. You defeat a system by withdrawing from it, because it's parasitic on your energy. And as soon as you pull back, even a few people doing this, pulling out of it, not paying taxes, not cooperating, you know, reclaiming the local buildings or courthouse for the Republic, whatever, we are taking back our energy and reversing that energy flow, and they collapse. So you don't defeat a system by attacking it. You withdraw and build your own system. and bring people into that system. And we always, I know I repeat that a lot, but it's very important to hammer that home with our people, because even those who take out citizenship will then say, yeah, but is it legal what we're doing? Are we allowed to do this? And again, it's what we get from childhood. You can't do anything without a parental figure telling you that it's okay. But the thing about sovereignty, and this is really clear if you read the Common Law Training Manual book, sovereignty is inborn. It's never given to us. Rights are never given to us. They only exist when we practice them. And we define those rights. The Canadian Charter of Rights is the old Roman law system. And I'm going to talk about this now. In Roman law, there's two streams in law. It's common law and Roman law, you know, in the European tradition. Roman law says that the ruler defines what your rights are. You're basically a slave. Your property owned by somebody else. And that was the system in Rome. And that's where we get the capitalized letter on our ID from. It's a term in Latin, which is capitis diminutia maxima, which means the maximum diminishing of head or authority. So a slave was a piece of property, just like a woman or a child in Rome, Roman and Greek culture. And it's signified by this capitalized letter, which is, this is a piece of property that is owned by somebody else, and they can dispose of that in any way they like. That's how you're seen by the system. You're seen as property, and that's designated by the all capitalized letter. You step out of that and they have no authority. They don't even see you. You're suddenly invisible because you're not part of their system anymore. And so there's that Roman tradition of law that says, we define your rights. We can take them away at any point. Basically, you exist to serve us and you can't say no to authority. That's the Roman way of thinking. It permeates everything in our culture, from religion to, you know, the way we look at God, right? Even this is really interesting. When people pray like this, that's not even a Christian or a symbol. That comes from the Middle Ages. Because when you swore oath to a feudal lord, you go like this. He'd put his hands around your hands and you are bound to him. So that's like seeing God as this big feudal lord and you're bound to him, right? It's this whole hierarchical way of thinking that permeates everything in our culture. So common law is the opposite. It says there are no hierarchies. No one is born subject to anybody else. We're all born natural, free, and equal. Okay, that's just common sense. Any kid knows that, right? That's why when parents tell them to do something, they go, like, why? You know. There was a really good writer, and you should all read this. I've got excerpts from this in a handout I'll send you. His name is Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and he wrote a book called The Social Contract in 1743. Now, Rousseau was really the philosopher of the French and the American revolutions, and he departed radically from everything up to then in political theory. Up to then, other writers would say, well, the sovereign, which is either a king or a parliament or a president, they have authority over you because they're protecting you. Therefore, you surrender everything, including your sovereignty, to them, and you have to obey them. Rousseau said, bullshit. That's not what goes on. We're born naturally free. He has this wonderful quote. He says, all people are born naturally free and equal. And because force doesn't impose right, by that he meant just because you've got the biggest club on the block doesn't mean you're the boss. Okay. That's not fair or just. The only way people can act together is through what he calls covenants. So yeah, or contracts in our language. In society, people form contracts with each other, and that's the basis on which government happens. So government is really a contract. That's why when you mark your ballot, you're not surrendering your authority. That's how Roman law thinks. You've marked a ballot, now we can do anything we like in your name. No, Rousseau said that when you delegate somebody, and that's the term we use in the Republic, there aren't representatives because you can't represent somebody else. Only you can represent yourself. You're a delegate. We elect you to a Congress as a delegate, but if you don't do what we want, what we've asked you to do for us, we can withdraw your support and we can depose you, right? We can vote you out at any point, not just an election. And so that system of direct democracy is very different than what we've been raised with, which is you obey the law, you're represented in parliament, you're being taken care of, right? That's a Canadian way of thinking. Americans traditionally think in a very different way because they came out of Rousseau and the social contract that says just because you vote, just because you pay your taxes, doesn't mean you surrender your sovereignty. You can step out of it at any point, and it's lawful to do so. And American courts continually uphold that right of the people to drop away. I mean, Thomas Jefferson even said, we need a, if the America doesn't have a revolution every 20 years, our republic is dead. And that's every generation. He says, every generation we have to renew ourselves, like in nature, we have to renew ourselves and return power to the people. And that's going in a totally different direction. That's what's going on now, which is that the corporation is making everybody work for it. And you don't have the right anymore to dissent or say no. We meet that every day. Like we talked about it, about, you know, what do we do if this store says we have to be vaccinated? Well, we don't have to cooperate with that. We find alternatives, right? We sue their ass. We make it embarrassing for them when they try to do that to us, right? Whatever. But we never have to surrender our sovereignty. Now, I'm sure you've got questions and comments about any of that, so I won't go on too much longer, but I do want to share a few things about language, which is really important. I mentioned already one, which is a representative. A lawyer or a politician will say, or a priest will say, I represent you. I'm representing you. I'm taking you, but then presenting you in a way that suits me. That's what they say in court, right? The judge won't recognize your case often unless you have a lawyer, because that he's part of the inside boys club, and they will redesign your case to fit their needs, not yours. So you never hand away authority like that. I mean, that's just one, I think, kind of obvious example. This is from a thing I'm going to send you as well. It's called Language is Power, the Meaning of Key Words. The word name, okay, I talked about earlier the capitalized letter saying that you're a piece of property, the name on the government ID you have. The word name comes from a Hebrew word, nomos, which means the nomos was a plaque that they would hang around the neck of a slave to say who owned them. So when you have a name, say Kevin Annett, name given to me when I was registered in Edmonton by my parents when I was born, a week later, that isn't who I am. That's a designation whereby the government of Canada recognizes me as a piece of property off which they're making money. In the Bible, it's interesting because Adam names all the creatures in Eden, and that way has control over them. God is asked, what is your name? And he says, I have no name. I am who I am. Now that's natural law speaking. That says, we have no name. We are who we are. So when the police stop you and they say, the first thing they always ask you in court or in when they're standing at your car asking, they say, are you so-and-so or what is your name? If you don't answer them, you nullify their power. They have no way of identifying you in their system. You just don't answer. You don't sign anything. You don't have to give your name because a name is something put on you. It's not coming from you unless you choose something. But we are in our essence, you know, spirit, energy. We're not a piece of property fit into their little box. So that's the whole importance of the thing about names. Here's another one. People talk about law versus statute. A statute, as you probably know, is a rule that the government brings in, you know, to administer itself or to make money. But the U.S. Supreme Court has said time and again, statute without the consent of the people is null and void. So they can bring in all the rules they want. They can bring in, and even these COVID measures now aren't even statute. It was never even passed in a legislature or court. It was just some health bureaucrat saying, you all have to do this now, right? So it has no basis in law or anything. We can, or and we say this to the police, I don't have to obey this and you shouldn't enforce it because it's not a law. It's not valid, right? But generally a statute is something a government brings in, but you don't have to obey it. If you don't consent to it, it has no authority over you. And that's true about anything the government does. Law is inherent. It's, you know, not just the law of nature. It's the way that the things are, the way that we naturally cooperate with each other to ensure our liberty, our freedom, our security, right? So law in nature is manifest all around us. It's just the way, it's common law is common sense, as should be obvious. Person, it's really interesting the word mask, because mask comes from a Greek word, persona. Okay, so when they say mask, it means we're giving you a new identity, a new persona. You are now this new thing, which is not really human. It's this image. Persona is, in law, when they say a person in court, it can refer to either a human being or a corporation. And the problem now is that corporations have the same rights as people under the law. They did that over 100 years ago. In essence, we're living in a corporatocracy where eventually there'll be one world corporation that everybody works for. And that's something the Pope supports with his one world religion. It's the direction of a lot of what's going on right now. Again, I'll just close on this. The language of that you're given in court is all based on slave master relationships. An appeal, it comes from an old French word, to beg. So when you make an appeal, I appeal the decisions. You're getting down your hands and knees and begging for something from a master. All of the language is implicit. Okay. And there's a lot more I could get into here, but I think I'll... okay, I can't resist. This one I always like to talk about. Apology. All right. This is classic doublethink. Whenever any bad shit comes out, like children being killed en masse by the churches and government, they immediately, when their pressure gets big enough on them, they immediately start talking about apology. They never say, I'm sorry. They say, I apologize. Well, if you look up apology in the Oxford Dictionary or any dictionary, you'll never see it described as I'm sorry. What apology means is to defend what you did. An apologetic in English literature, it's like he wrote an apologetic to defend somebody else's work, okay? An apology means I'm not sorry. I didn't do anything wrong. I'm justifying what I did. So when a politician gets up and says, we apologize, it's saying we didn't do anything wrong and we're legally indemnifying or excusing ourselves for any wrongdoing. That's exactly what happened in Canada in 2008. Stephen Harper got up in Parliament and apologized for residential schools. That said, we indemnify ourselves. And that's what happened. The Catholic, Anglican, United Churches were off the hook. None of their people ever went to jail for the murder of 60,000 or more children. The government is safe. They pay off a bit of hush money to some survivors, and that's it. They've excused themselves from their own crime through an apology. So that's very important. It's how, you know, most people hear apology. Oh, good. They're sorry now. It's all fixed. That's for the masses. It's like the notion of democracy. It's like, yeah, you can have your little ballot and think that you're in control of your life, but that's pablum for the masses. In reality, what they're saying, they're laughing up their sleeves saying, hey, we just indemnified ourselves. We're off the hook for our own crimes. And you think we're sorry. Great. That's how the system works. It's always doing everything to their advantage, to the advantage of a few people. And I think in closing, I just want to say, thing we've ever been taught from day one in this culture and in any system of elite control, going back thousands of years, everything you're taught is designed to do one thing, and that's channel power into the hands of a few. And all of the language, everything is designed to reinforce our status as slaves. That's how we're seen. Even the vaccination protocols, they talk about herd immunization. When they talk about how to protect people from a virus, quote, they call us a herd. We're cattle to them, right? So, you know, I mean, that's, again, that as we have experience dealing with the system, we learn this the hard way, but that's the ideas that we're raised with. And don't forget, final note, every genocide in human history, any act of tyranny is usually described as a public health measure. In Nazi Germany, when they were rounding up lots of people, they said, you know, political undesirables, Jews, Slavs, they're vermin. They're a health threat to us. That's the language they use. They're a threat to the health of our society. Therefore, we have to lock them away. Genocide in Canada was described as a health measure to help these dirty Indians. That's how the residential schools and Indian hospitals were set up, because church groups said they're going to spread tuberculosis to us unless we confine them in these residential schools. Well, in fact, we were spreading the disease to them, but it made it look like we were going to be infected by this disease. Look what's happening today. There goes any notion of a democratic society or accountability because of this mysterious bug that doesn't actually exist. You know, it's always about health measures. And psychologically, it's a great way to get to people because you see what happens when you don't put on the muzzle. People get angry at you. You've got people fighting each other and they sit back and laugh all the way to the bank, right? Big pharma and their government puppets. So I'm going to leave it there because I got to rest my voice, but that's, I welcome now comments, questions, and how especially we can relate it to our work. I didn't get into that because, you know, we should talk about how this relates to the work we're doing locally, your situation, you know, any concerns you have, but I'll leave it at that for now. And let's just open it up for questions and comments. Thanks.